We're beginning a quirky weekly show, chatting art, transport, communications, history. I'm going to get you as fascinated by these subjects as myself and the guests. So welcome aboard the Catchcast. In today's edition, we take our phones for granted. You may even be playing with yours right now. But do you ever think about how this extraordinary device came into our lives? Well, today we're talking telephones. From Britain's first call by Queen Victoria through the start of the internet to that smartphone in your hand. And we're honoured to have with us the country's foremost emeritus professor of telecommunications, author of many esteemed papers and expert in connecting computers, Nigel Linge. Welcome to Catchcast.
Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Nigel.
Fighting me.
You're very welcome. Now, Alexander Graham Bell may have invented the telephone, but it was Queen Victoria, wasn't it, who made that first British call from Osborne House in East Cowes on the Isle of Wight over to the mainland in 1878. Can you tell us a bit about how that came about, Nigel?
Yeah, it was the evening of the 14th of January, as you say, in Osborne House. I'm not sure whether Queen Victoria actually made the call, because I think it was more like Alexander Graham Bell demonstrating it. And at the time, of course, it was just what we call a point-to-point connection. It connected the council room in Osborne House to Osborne Cottage. But later on that evening, they were also able to link it across to the mainland and made calls into Southampton and London, which was quite special, really. So it was the demonstration of the first telephone call, a publicly witnessed telephone call. And as you say, that really kick-started the whole love affair we have with the telephone.
Well, that's amazing. And do we know who she or Alexander Graham Bell spoke to at the time?
Well, we know that Princess Beatrice and the Duke of Connaught were present. And we also knew that songs were sung across the telephone. But not altogether sure exactly who was on each of the two ends, or the other end, to what Queen Victoria was at.
And I wonder how often she actually used the telephone device after that.
Well, I don't think she used it at all, actually, because I have no evidence that she had any installed in any of the royal residences. You know, obviously, when you're launching a new piece of technology, if you can get it in front of the monarch, you get an awful lot of publicity and kudos for that. And so I think Alexander Graham Bell certainly benefited from having Queen Victoria present at this very first call.
I bet he did. And where did those next early telephone instruments get installed then? Do we know how fast the telephone was adopted?
Yeah, about 12 days later, actually. And that happened up in Manchester, because the first telephone that was installed by the post office using Bell's system was actually done to a hardware merchant in Manchester. And that was in later that month, January 1878. And this is just short of 2 years since Bell submitted his patent in 1876. So in that sense, it's fairly rapid. And that Manchester telephone was, again, a point-to-point connection. So we can well imagine that Thomas Hudson, who was a hardware merchant, he had two premises in Manchester, and he had a phone connecting the two premises together. So I guess it meant he didn't have to run between the two buildings and he could just phone across for anything he wanted. But the following year, 1879, we get the first telephone exchanges in Britain. And the first one officially was in London. And so that could only happen if there are sufficient people with telephones that want to connect.
And what would have those early telephone exchanges been like? I mean, how would people have made a call at the time?
Well, the telephone would have looked quite different. For the starters, there would have been no dial or push buttons on them. They would have probably had just one microphone that acted as a speaker as well. In other words, you had to switch it when you were talking. So when you were talking, you spoke into the microphone. When you flicked the switch, you listened through that same microphone to the other person speaking. So they look radically different to what we have today. And of course, the way they were connected, you had to have a person to physically connect one wire into the next using a plug and socket keyboard or manual exchange board.
So these were our early operators, I think we ended up calling them, didn't we?
Absolutely, yes, they certainly were. Yes, our first telephone operators, indeed.
And every single call had to go via an operator then. I mean, what would it have been like if you wanted to quickly get hold of someone? What would have been the process?
Oh, well, a lot of these telephone operators, telephone exchanges, were in private houses. And the owner of the house actually had to commit to being prepared to manually connect calls 24 hours a day. But of course, what happened was when a lot of these phones had what was called a magneto on the side, it was a little handle that you rotated, and that generated electricity which could ring a bell at the exchange. So basically, you turn the handle, that rang a bell at the exchange. The operator would then wake up or whatever what they were doing, speak to you. You would say, oh, can you connect me to whoever? And they would plug the appropriate plug into that socket, and there you are. You could then speak. And the operator would probably also be able to ring the bell at the person you were calling. So it was a very manually intensive process.
So those operators then, they must have played quite a crucial role in the telephonic life in the Victorian times. Were there ever any, I don't know, conflicts of interest?
Well, there was a particularly famous story, not in this country, but over in America, that led to a massive revolution in technology, actually. And that occurred over in Kansas in America and involved an undertaker. And that undertaker was called Ullman B. Strowger. And I'm not sure whether it was his wife or his girlfriend. She was a telephone operator, but so too was the wife of one of his competitors. So when somebody rang the phone and this operator answered and the person said, oh, can you connect me to the undertaker, please? Ullman B. Strowger felt that maybe he wasn't getting the fair share of the business because the person, the operator on duty at that time, was rather, shall we say, favouring his competitor. And so he, believe it or not, set about trying to eliminate the human operator from the telephone system. And what he eventually developed was an electromechanical system that could make that connection for you. And that's when we started to get the rotary dial on the phone, because that was the first time when you were able to dial someone rather than asking the operator, connect me to the doctor, connect me to the undertaker or whatever.
Wow, so there was a lot of experimentation going on even in that early period. I read somewhere, I don't know if you know about this one, that there was an early experiment in wireless connectivity way back in 1882 between Southampton and Newport on the Isle of Wight.
That's true, but you have to be very careful with what is meant by the word wireless.
Okay.
It's not radio. Basically, there was a... You've got to remember that telephone. The telephone followed on from the electric telegraph. And the electric telegraph was well established before the telephone emerged. In fact, Bell's patent was titled Improvement in Telegraphy. So there was a telegraph cable linking the mainland to the Isle of Wight, laid actually in 1853. And that could carry, if you like, Morse code, dots and dashes, electric telegraph messages. And that cable failed. So William Preece, who was essentially the chief engineer of the post office, had wanted to experiment with a different way of transmitting electricity. And this was effectively what's known as electric conduction through the earth. So what he did, he had a copper plate, which he could place in the water, and a copper plate on the other side of the solent. And he could send electricity effectively using the earth as an electrical conductor.
Wow.
And obviously we know about earthing electrical supplies and so on. So the earth operated as a conductor. And it was called wireless because there was technically no wire connecting one end of the solent to the other. But it was not radio. It was an electrical conduction experiment. But absolutely true.
Great inventors, weren't they?
So it was done. Oh, hugely innovative period.
Let's just talk about telephone kiosks, because it wasn't just for rich people, was it? Anyone could use a phone in a little call office.
You could. And in fact, it was the Postmaster General, Henry Fawcett of 1884, who allowed telephone companies to place telephones in public places. Until that point, you had to be a subscriber of a telephone company. And there were lots of different telephone companies generally doing small regional or city type installations. But in 1884, Henry Fawcett, as Postmaster General, said, OK, you can now put a phone in a public place. and anyone can use it for the payment of a fee. Well, if you're going to put a phone in a public place, what are you going to put it in? And that was really the birth of what we now call the telephone box or the telephone kiosk. And so you'd see in shops, this little cabinet would appear pretty much like, shall we say, a military sentry box with windows in. And you could go in there and there'd be a phone, you could make a payment and you could dial anyone else on that particular phone system. So that's what we used to call silence cabinets or call officers. And that was the birth of what has become the telephone box.
Crikey. Tell us a little tiny bit more about how those lovely red ones were designed, please, Nigel.
Yes, well, of course, it didn't happen overnight. But originally, the telephone was operated by lots and lots of different companies. And they all started introducing the equivalent of a telephone box. Now, eventually, the telephone system's effectively nationalised and comes under the post office. And the post office then decide that they want a standard design of phone box for the entire country. And so they come up with this design, and the telephone phone box is then known as a kiosk. So once the GPO start designing telephone boxes, they call them kiosks. And so the first one becomes known as a K1. And that's what, of course, the Isle of Wight has in Bembridge. You have a K1 on the Isle of Wight. Again, it looks like a sentry box. The one on in Bembridge is a later model of that, and it's got a lot more windows than the original one. But what not a lot of people realise is that it's actually made of concrete, except the door. So actually the walls and the roof are actually cast concrete, because that turned out to be cheaper at the time they developed it. And they launched that in 1921, after the First World War. Now, the trouble was, although the K1 was functional, when it was installed in London, the Metropolitan Boroughs were not happy. In fact, the superintendent of the Royal Parks is on record of effectively saying, "Over my dead body will one of those go in my parks." So London's really unhappy. And the GPO thought, "Oh, what are we going to do about this?" So they set up a competition with the Royal Fine Art Commission to try and design something better. And three prominent architects were invited to submit designs. And cutting the story short, Sir Giles Gilbert Scott won that design. And so his design then was adopted. And because it followed on from the K1, this became known as the K2. And you see these in London, although it wasn't exclusive to London. And that's the first red phone box. And it's quite big. It's over 9 feet tall. Oh, it's about 3'6" square, cast iron, except the door, which is teak. And that's when we start to see the red phone box appear on the streets. But that was the K2. The one that most people would recognise as the red phone box is also a Giles Gilbert Scott design. That came much later in 1936, and that's known as the K6. Hence, there were obviously that was the sixth iteration of phone box later. So the one that you have in the Isle of Wight, the K1, is obviously the first design they came up with. And I've also got discovered another piece of interesting news about Isle of Wight kiosks. There was another K1 on Ventnor Railway Station.
Ah.
And that still survives, but it's been moved.
Ah.
And it's been moved to Avoncroft Museum in Bromsgrove near Birmingham. Mm. And it's officially part of the National Telephone Kiosk Collection.
And those things did proliferate, didn't they, across the whole country? The red telephone box became as symbolic of Britain as a red London bus or whatever. There were so many of them, weren't there?
I always say to people, what's the archetypical English village? Well, you've got probably a church, a thatched cottage, a duck pond, a pub and a red phone box. And Britain sort of stands alone, really, on the world stage as the only country that uses a phone box as part of its national identity.
Wow.
But when you see a red phone box, you know where it comes from.
Telephones obviously proliferated right across the country in phone boxes and in people's homes. And we're going to skip ahead a little bit now. And I want to ask you about the first mobile phones. And I only learnt recently that Britain was kind of in the lead in developing mobile phone coverage. How did all that happen, Nigel?
Well, again, we just have to be slightly careful with the word mobile, because the first mobile phones were actually called radio phones. and they would be in the car, not things we carry around with us as we do today. The one we carry around with us today is technically called a cellular mobile phone. So just to backtrack then, the first radio phone service which was available to you and I as members of the general public was the South Lancashire Radio Phone Service of 1959, later followed by the London Radio Phone Service. But that was quite limited in terms of its capacity, in terms of how many phone calls and telephones it could support. Plus, the phones were so big, they were installed in vehicles. However, in 1985, the UK launched its first cellular service, firstly Vodafone and then Cellnet, BT Cellnet, in January 85. So we've just celebrated the 40th anniversary of that momentous time. And that's the cellular phone, which today is the smartphone.
Right. So we were ahead of the game a little bit with those radio phones, but perhaps quite not as far advanced as the Americans with the cellular development.
Yeah. That's right. The cellular system was developed in America. Well, it was first of all developed by Bell Telephone Labs after the Second World War. However, the technology wasn't up to standard. They couldn't do it. They couldn't implement it. So it was Motorola in 1973, Dr. Martin Cooper, who actually developed the truly first hand-portable cellular phone over in America. The first cellular systems in this Europe were in Scandinavia. And then UK came along in 85, as I said, with the version of the American system for what I suppose today we'd probably call it 1G, because we talk about modern phones as 5G and so on. The first generation.
And at the same sort of time in the 1980s, we also had the renaming of our telephone services, British Telecom, didn't we?
We did. We had privatisation, because it's strange, because when the telephone started in Bell's day, it was private companies predominantly that drove that. Then they were nationalised. From 1912, all under the post office, except, of course, our citizens of Hull. The Hull telephone service did remain fiercely independent and was never part of the national picture. But for everyone else, nationalised system, until we get in the 1980s and the Thatcher government starts privatising things and inevitably privatise the telephone system, where we go to British Telecom and then BT.
When was the first in-flight call made? I'm sure it must have been in the 60s or 70s, mustn't it?
Well, no, that was staggeringly early. There was a test call made in 1920.
Wow.
On an aeroplane flying to Paris and made a radio call down to someone in London. So according to BT Research, that was the first one.
Goodness. What about the speaking clock? I don't know if any of our listeners remember that. When did that start?
That came in 1936. And that was an electromechanical system whereby people could phone up and they could listen to the third stroke and they would get regular time intervals.
Now, when I was a kid, I used to get into trouble for running up the phone bill. And one of the things I used to do was ring something called dial-a-disc. Mm. When did that become possible, to play records down the phone?
Well, you're showing your age now. Of course, that 1966 that was launched. So it's a 1960s thing, that. And you could listen to the record of the week or whatever.
We're talking telephones with Britain's emeritus telecommunications professor, Nigel Land. And we're going to bring ourselves right up to date now with how the internet got going. Now, we have to go back a bit in time, don't we? Wasn't there something called ARPANET? Tell me about that, Nigel.
Yes, that's right. We've got to go back, in fact, to 1969, which is a lot earlier than a lot of people think for the internet. And that's the time when computers filled whole rooms and buildings, and they were so big. And over in America, they were really looking to try to get value for money out of these large machines. And the Advanced Research Project Agency, ARPA, were funding a lot of these computers, and they decided that they needed a network to link them together and then more people could have access to them. And that became known as the ARPANET. And this started on West Coast America and then spread across to East Coast. They put a satellite link in to the UK in 1970, and the internet was what wasn't called the internet then. The ARPANET was demonstrated in this country. And there is a direct line from those early days to what we call the internet today. But what really transformed it was, in fact, Sir Tim Berners-Lee, he wasn't Sir Tim then, who created what we now know as the World Wide Web. And he did that in 1989. So effectively, the internet was 20 years old when he did that. And then the World Wide Web comes along, and all of a sudden, there's a value to you and me and the general public having access. Prior to the web, the people using the internet were academics in universities, people working for large corporations, people working in research facilities, but not the general public. The web is what changed it.
Was that straight after Tim Berners-Lee got involved then? I mean, I remember those very noisy modem things that made sort of poop noise as you went along. I mean, did that come straight away after that, or was that later into the 90s?
So what happened was Tim Berners-Lee produced his blueprint in 1989. It took a few years for that to roll out, as it were, across the internet and become known. And then people were said, well, how do we connect to this thing called the internet? And the only means of connection people had in their homes was the telephone line. And so you had to use the telephone line to connect to this data network called the ARPANET. And that's when the modem was developed. And the early modems in the late 70s used to be called acoustic couplers. And you would actually take the handset of the telephone and plug it in these two rubber suction cups. And it would play the music, you know, play the tones, each other, the bird squeaks and things that we heard at the time through the microphone and listen to the speaker side of the handset. But what changed to help that development was, I really remember, we changed from the telephone being hardwired in our homes to actually being allowed to have what's called a plug and a socket. And then you could move your phone around the house. And that meant you could have an electrical connection straight into the telephone line. And that's when we see the modems develop really strongly through the 80s and then into the 90s. And we had people called the V90 modem and the 56 kilobits per second speeds of modems, which was, you know, leading edge at the time. So into the 2000s is when we start getting broadband and everyone wanting access to the internet.
And that's when we started looking about trying to get them onto our phones as well. But how did that then evolve to these handheld devices we love today, the smartphone?
You see, the mobile phone and the internet, you know, 1989, Tim Berners-Lee, 1985, cellular, they started to follow a very similar timeline. So they're in parallel paths. So you start seeing more computer features being added into the telephones, in other words, to become more than just a phone. And in 1999, Nokia launched the Nokia 7110, which included a web browser built into the phone. I have to say, it wasn't very good, but at least the technology was moving in that direction. And then in 2000, Ericsson launched the R380. It had all these computer features on it, and they thought, what are we going to call it? It's not a phone anymore. And they created the word smartphone. Uh-huh. So the Ericsson R380 was the first phone branded as a smartphone, using the word, in other words, to describe something which had moved on from just being a simple phone for talking to other people on. And it's gone on from there to what we have today.
And it makes me wonder what's next. Are we going to end up with these things implanted into our heads, do you think, Nigel?
I hope not. I hope not. But what we see now, if you look at a modern smartphone, what differentiates it, it's really the software. I mean, so if you put a series of modern phones on the table, I would struggle to know which was which. They all look the same. But it's the software that differentiates them now. And that's where we're going to see a lot of advance. Yes, we're going to see artificial intelligence capability in the phones. It's already coming in. That's going to develop. The camera is already creating all sorts of capability and gets more and more sophisticated each year. We'll see a lot of development there, but I don't quite buy into the science fiction of phones implanted in the human body just yet.
Well, that's probably a bit of a relief, isn't it, to people listening? We have been on a whirlwind tour from Queen Victoria making the first phone call from the Isle of Wight to the mainland in 1878 to what we hold in our hands today. And we have to thank our wonderful guest, Nigel Linge, the Emeritus Professor of Telecommunications at University of Salford. Fascinating discussion. I hope you enjoyed learning as much as I have. Thank you so much for being there, Nigel. Next week's Catchcast is not to be missed. How to talk to people on the other side of the world without using any kind of telephone. We discuss those people with huge aerials in their back gardens, the radio hams. So catch you then.